playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands. Playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the Irish Times Weekend Edition. Your weekend's in good hands with our sumptuous food features, intrepid travel stories and engrossing sports coverage.
Good morning. It's been a long time coming. 5 years after Enda Kenny made his historic apology in the Dáil, on Tuesday, a further apology from President Michael D. Higgins to the Magdalen survivors.
You were failed by governments that knowingly relied on the existence and practices of these institutions rather than addressing your particular needs in other, more sympathetic ways. You were also failed by a society that actively colluded by their silence in your incarceration and treatment, or who chose to look the other way.
This was a bittersweet week for women who had survived incarceration in the Magdalen laundries, hidden behind high convent walls, in mother and baby homes, sent there by their families, the church, the state, because maybe they were too attractive, too wild, too sassy for their own good. Others ended up slaving in the laundries for no good reason, or simply because they were poor. 230 Magdalen women and their families travelled to Dublin from America, Australia, Switzerland, all over England and across Ireland for a special two-day gathering in their honour, a chance to unravel the secrets and the lies, to tell their stories and put an end to the stigma for once and for all. Mary Carvener is nearly 79. She was sent to live in the Good Shepherd home in Cork at the age of 11. She spoke with Mary Wilson on Drive Time.
I can remember it like it happened yesterday, leaving the courthouse with the cruelty man and my two brothers sitting in the back, getting up to the convent. And what broke my heart and what I think about all these years is I turned to my brothers and I said, look, if we don't meet in this life, we'll meet in the next. It broke my heart. We weren't allowed to talk at all, so you could never make any friends. You just talk, and that's what I'm saying. That's what it's affected me all through my life, the need to communicate with people. It was absolutely awful. You wouldn't believe. It wasn't the children's fault. They were in the same position as I was. I enjoyed looking after the babies, you know, at night time. I was totally exhausted. I was only a little girl. I was only 11, for God's sake, you know. But the one thing it taught me, and that was, you know, to look after my children. I'm a slave to my children. They're all grown up, of course.
Mary Carvener. Well, the gathering to honour the Magdalen women was organised by the voluntary group Dublin Honours Magdalens. Businesswoman Nora Casey was the organisational powerhouse driving the event. She was at Dublin Airport and described the atmosphere as the women touched down.
Well, it's amazing to start meeting people for the first time. You have to remember, for the last month or two, I've probably talked to these women 2, 3, 4 times. I feel like I know them all, and then finally I'm getting to meet them face to face. And there's a mixture of, I don't know, it's a lot of emotion. The AA allowed me to go the other side so that I could talk to them. A lot of our women have requested anonymity, and I wanted to make sure that before they got sort of snapped by all the cameras outside, that I could make sure that they were taken off into a quiet space and preserve their need for confidentiality. But it is quite emotional, and for a lot of them, you know, well, it's, you know, a flight, I think, that they haven't taken for a very long time. So stepping back in Ireland has been monumental. Got about 22 just coming in now from Stansted, and I know that will be very emotional. I know an awful lot of those women, it would rip your heart out. There's not one of them that said, my life has been fantastic since this happened to me. They all have stories like Mary that you just heard from. For me, I think it's just really important, after all those bad memories, especially when you hear from Mary that she just really only told her family since the redress scheme, and her daughter is here, and it's something else to remember, which I think is more positive, you know, that there's another memory there, which is about the president greeting them, about Gardaí, respectful outriders and arriving into the Mansion House. It's just so important that they get that respect and dignity.
Nora Casey heard on Monday's Drive Time. Kathleen Abbey travelled from Switzerland to attend the gathering. She came from a poor rural family in Portlaoise. She and her sister Bridget were only 12 and 13 when they were sent by their parish priest to St Mary's in Stanhope Street in Dublin. As Kathleen told Richard Curran, her parents were led to believe she was going there for a better education.
I was very good at school, and we were told that, don't worry, when you go to Dublin, you can carry on, you can go back to school. They had their own school, Stanhope Street. So I was quite excited, thinking, I'll just go to school when I go up there, that'll be fine. And so we went up, and when we got there, I still remember walking up these long corridors and thinking, it was actually frightening for young girls, and I think quite stressy. But then I went to school, but only for 3 months. And after these 3 months, the nuns decided that they made it sound good for you. They told you, you're a very intelligent girl and we need you more in the laundry. You could do more work there than just going to school. And I remember saying to them, but you can't do that. You told my parents I could carry on education. But they said, oh, we'll speak to your parents and we'll sort all that out. So I never went back to school. I was then 12 years of age.
And you were working then from the age of 12?
Then you worked, you got up at 6 o'clock in the morning, you went to church, you had to, had breakfast. Then we went down to the laundries, we worked till 12 o'clock, had lunch, which was an hour break, back to work till 6 o'clock. And then you had a few hours for ourselves in a sort of recreation room.
And what was the atmosphere like? Did you have much of a chance to spend time with your sister?
No. What is very important you have to know is it was very regimental. I think what disturbed us most was we were not allowed to speak. And I did, because I felt, why did anybody ever give me a mouth and 2 ears and if I'm not allowed to use them? And when I spoke to my sister, I was put outside every door. I sat on every stairs, and they gave us a Bible because they thought that'll make me a good girl, but it didn't. I still carried on to speak.
And how were you addressed? Were you addressed by...
We were addressed, no. Well, very
your
important.
Your first name or your surname?
As I say,
or...
I was christened Kathleen and my sister was Bridget. But they decided that we didn't need a name, so we were called by numbers. My sister was 63 and I was number 64 and we never had a name.
And if somebody wanted to speak to you, they would refer to you just by your
yes,
number?
Yes, they would call you out. Number 64, can you please come here? I want to tell you something. It was degrading.
Kathleen was 16 when she finally left the laundry. She says she's never got over the psychological trauma and fled Ireland as soon as she could, educating herself and eventually training as a midwife.
And I remember saying to my dad, I'm leaving Ireland because they don't offer me anything. And up until now, they have not done a very good job looking after us.
Did you tell your husband and your family about those
no,
years?
No, which is interesting. You will never believe this. I never, ever spoke about the Madeleine Laundry other than Stanhope Street, even with my sister, until it came into your newspapers in Ireland. I don't know the year. And my sister saw it in the paper and rang me up in Switzerland. I even didn't tell my children until my son was 40 and my daughter 38 when I told her.
It's okay. Okay.
Sorry.
It's okay. Have a drink. You're all right, Kathleen. It's fine.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Kathleen Abbey heard on the Today Show on Tuesday. Since the foundation of the state, over 11,000 women spent time in the Magdalene laundries. Many of these women are now in their 70s, 80s and 90s. And after Enda Kenny's apology, the Magdalene Restorative Justice Scheme was set up by Justice Peter Quirk. Two of his key recommendations were, firstly, that the women would get the opportunity to come together to share their stories, and secondly, that they would be consulted on how they would like to be remembered. Over the years, many groups have campaigned tirelessly on behalf of the Magdalens, among them the Justice for Magdalens Research Group, Catherine O'Donnell, Claire McGettrick, and lawyer Maeve O'Rourke, who spoke with Richard Curran.
Many of us will remember former Taoiseach Enda Kenny's emotional address in the Dáil on the Magdalene survivors. What do you think was the lasting effect of that speech?
It was a really big step for the Irish state, but it's really important, I think, that we realise it was actually only the first time that the Irish state accepted that what had happened in Magdalene laundries was wrong and that the state was responsible in a very large way for what had happened to all of the girls and women there. And I think that's what brings us to today. That's what has led to the 5 years of campaigning and fighting by individual women and by lots of other people to fix problems with the redress scheme. And now we have the gathering today. It's really only the beginning of dealing with our legacy.
Now, the Ombudsman, Peter Tindall, produced a report in November in relation to the redress scheme and how that worked. He identified a number of flaws in the scheme, which this morning, Justice Minister Charlie Flanagan is saying he's going to adopt and rectify. How significant is that?
That's really, really welcome. It's been a very long 5 years for women who were excluded from the scheme, even though they really should have been included from the very start. So one of the recommendations the Ombudsman made was that women who had been put on the rolls of adjoining children's institutions, but in fact had been worked every day in the Magdalen laundries, they should be included. The state had actually never said that the women didn't work in Magdalen's. It had just on this technicality said, well, you weren't admitted because the nuns didn't put you on the rolls. We accept you were in there and working. So those women have now been included or will be shortly. And that's really welcome because it was extremely stressful for them. And it was another experience of not being listened to, of being disbelieved. There are other important recommendations now that are going to be implemented. There was an issue around the fact that a lot of women received less money from the scheme than the time they had claimed for. And the Ombudsman found that their evidence, their testimony about how long they'd spent in Magdalen laundries was disregarded, and that the officials in the department had simply asked the nuns what the length of stay was and hadn't seen the women's evidence, their testimony or that of their families as evidence. There's also a question about women who were deemed to lack capacity, and we've been raising this issue for a very long time. There are a lot of women who never left Magdalen laundries who now live institutionalised in the care of the nuns, and a number of those have been deemed to lack the sufficient financial capacity. So those women, because the Assisted Decision Making Capacity Act had never come into law and still hasn't fully come into effect, they weren't admitted into the scheme. They've now been made wards of court, but I think it's really important that they're given independent advocates.
Lawyer Maeve O'Rourke heard on the Today Show on Tuesday. Well, later that day, the Magdalen women were honoured at a tea party with President Michael D. Higgins and his wife, Sabina Higgins, at Áras an Uachtaráin. Professor Jim Smith of Boston College is the author of Ireland's Magdalen Laundries, and he told Mary Wilson about the build-up to that magical trip.
I ran into a woman at 7:15 and she was dressed to the nines. She was dressed this morning because she was so looking forward to this afternoon. We got on 9 buses and they held us in convoy, and we were escorted by a troop of motorcycle Garda Síochána. And the women were wise to the metaphor or to the significance of the symbol. Now the police were escorting them. And in the past, one lady in the bus that I travelled in said, they're not here to bring us back. Mm-hmm. They closed the roads and the women laughed and clapped and waved at people who stood out from their house and waved at them, especially in the neighbourhood around Phoenix Park. And then we turned into the gate, and the Garda Síochána who were at the gate waved at them and welcomed them. And then there was a wonderful welcome outside the front door. The ladies walked through the corridors with the busts of former Irish presidents and with the visual history of our country on the walls, a picture of Mary Robinson that many women stopped in front of. A few of them passed by Eamon de Valera, it has to be said. And then they came out the back to be greeted by President Higgins, who so extended himself and walked from table to table and generously responded to every selfie and made time for the women, for their husbands and their sons and daughters in some cases, and for the volunteers. It's just a very special day. It's such an indication, such a measure of how far we've come.
Professor Jim Smith heard on Drive Time, and that evening there were emotional scenes as hundreds of people lined the streets of Dublin to honour the Magdalens as they arrived at the Mansion House, dolled up to the nines for a glitzy gala dinner and a concert with Christy Moore, Dana and Mary Byrne. Aisling Kenny was there for Morning Ireland.
How were you feeling walking in with all those people applauding you?
I feel like a pop star. I feel like a star. This is absolutely fantastic.
Tell me about your experience in the Magdalen laundries. What was it like?
Oh, it wasn't very nice, I remember that. But I tell you something now, and I mean this most sincerely. I was lucky. I got out of there, and a lot of poor people didn't.
But I worked in the laundry instead of going to school. I wasn't given secondary school education at all. I worked in the morning from morning till night, slaves, continuous all day. We didn't have a choice. didn't fight back because we knew we would be punished.
I'm emotional. I didn't know this was going to happen. I thought we were just going to go out, come out and get in. But when I see that and everyone knows about us, it's just, oh wow, at last.
What does tonight mean to you?
It means a lot because at last we're being heard. Yeah. We're being heard after all these years. I was in there in the 60s and now look, you know, we're getting heard and we're getting believed.
Are you satisfied with the government's apology now? Do you think they've done enough?
Well, the president today at the Aras an Uachtaráin, he went up and made a speech and he apologised and he really was very sincere.
People shook hands and applauded the women as they made their way into the event.
Why have you come here tonight?
Just to say Bula Bus to Manona here.
We were around those times and we did not know what was going on and we didn't do anything, you know. So we're out in sympathy with them that they have survived. They must have had horrible lives and amazing lives at different times. So we wanted to be here tonight to welcome them.
Branded as a Jezebel, she knew she was not bound for heaven. She had been cast in shame into the Magdalene Laundry.
Inside, the crowds were entertained by most singers including Christy Moore, Dana and Mary Byrne. The Minister for Justice and Equality, Charlie Flanagan, again apologised to the women.
I want, of course, to state that Official Ireland took its time. And the truth is that you had to wait far too long for acknowledgement, far too long for recognition, far too long for an official apology. So I'm proud that Enda Kenny was the Taoiseach who finally made the state apology. And following the Ombudsman's report, I need to add my own, which I now do. My department worked hard to administer the redress scheme, but we didn't always get it right. And I'm sorry for that. And I apologise to you now.
Snowdrops and daffodils, butterflies and bees.
What did you think of tonight?
It meant so much. You have no idea how much it meant. That there's nobody judging me anymore. That there's hundreds of us not being judged. I can talk openly now to my family. I can talk openly now to my children that I couldn't before and not hide things because I've hidden things for a long time.
An extract there from Aisling Kenny's report from the gala dinner at the Mansion House, heard on Morning Ireland. Well, the Magdalene visit was also a topic on The Gathering yesterday, with journalists Sinead O'Carroll and Brenda Power and politicians John Paul Phelan and Joan Burton.
The events in the Mansion House and particularly the President's reception in Aras an Uachtaráin, I think that was something that was long overdue. People who read the accounts of some of the lives, you couldn't not but be moved to tears. The school I went to in Stanhope Street had a laundry attached. So at the time of my Holy Communion, my mother took me in to meet the women in the laundry and I went in my dress and I can remember being both terrified because the machines and everything were just absolutely enormous to me as a small child, and the women equally were incredibly nice to me. And one of the women who worked in the laundry always came to our house on a Tuesday night, and she had to be back in the convent before 9 o'clock. And then some programme after we got a TV was on, something like the Reardons was on, and it literally broke her heart to have to leave, you know, because she had to go home. And we called her our aunt. I'm not sure if she was actually our aunt.
Brenda Power, what do we do with the Magdalene Laundry buildings is another question.
Before I go on to that, Richard, can you just come back to the question of why it has taken so long? I mean, the point is, this was a great source of shame. A lot of these women would not have told their families where they grew up or what their background was. Do you know what I mean? So to say, why is it only now? Because, you know, this kind of catharsis takes time to work through, as for an individual and for a nation. What we should do with the buildings, I think the women should be consulted about that, frankly. I'd say they'd want them levelled.
Sinead.
One of the women suggested a Remembrance Day every year. Yeah. And I was thinking, God, that actually makes sense, because it is a day to put aside that we will talk about it and that we will teach our children about it, which I think think is important. Mm.
The other thing I was going to say was that, and John Paul there was talking about adoption information, there were about 40,000 people formally legally adopted in Ireland since adoption legislation was introduced in the 1950s. And believe it or not, they're actually the only group of people who have no right, no legal right to information about themselves. So this is a story that has a lot of different chapters. The boys particularly who are cruelly abused and treated in institutions and orphanages.
So there's still a lot that's unknown.
And I do think as a society we should remember it. For instance, if you think of the memorials to concentration camps in the Second World War, I think perhaps maybe working with artists to create something which is imaginative, but which, like Sinead was saying, school children of today and future children can go along and say, this was what the history was like. Let's never do that again.
From Today with Richard Curran yesterday. Well, as Joan Burton mentioned there, the story of the falsification of birth certs at St Patrick's Guild in Dublin has reverberated around the world. The writer, Katrina Palmer, was adopted from there. She's written a memoir, An Affair with My Mother, a story of adoption, secrecy and love, which catalogues the prominent role the Guild played in Ireland's illegal adoption racket. She gave a wide-ranging interview to Mary Wilson on Bank Holiday Monday.
You found your mother, as you say, difficulties in that relationship now. Did you try or have you had any success in finding your birth father?
I know the identity of my birth father and I talk a little bit about that in my memoir. I know where he lives, I have his address, but I have not reached out to him. And I think that's an important point to make. I think there was a huge amount of fear surrounding the issue of whether adoptees should have access to their birth records and their birth certs. My mother is a secret in my life. I have known where she has lived for 20 years, and yet I have not knocked on her door. I have not even walked down her street. Likewise, I have not knocked on my birth father's door. But my birth father is an important aspect of this story because he got to walk away. There was no culpability in his life, no ramifications whatsoever. The men in Ireland walked away while the women, like my mother, suffered immensely. And that is something that we need to take into consideration too. My birth mother has lived a bifurcated, difficult life since she lost me 46 years ago. And that is a crime in itself, and that must change.
Katrina, how do you restrain yourself from arriving on that doorstep, from saying, I am here, I know where you live, I just want to know what you look like, I want to know, have I siblings, have I aunts, have I uncles?
It's very difficult. But I have tried to deal with the situation with as much compassion and integrity as possible. My father has another family, and I would not intrude on them in that way. The internet is an extraordinary device in this new world for adoptees. St. Patrick's Guild and the other agencies had not considered what would happen decades later. You know, I can see people online, and that's one way of easing the pain and knowing that he's alive and that he's living a life, as is my birth mother. But it's very difficult.
Does he know about you? Does he know anything?
I don't know, actually. A family member who knows about me did reach out to him many years ago to say that I had approached her, and his exact words were, sure, that was a long time ago, I wouldn't be remembering. And I think that's very telling. Because when my birth mother told him 46 years ago or 47 years ago that she was pregnant, he simply said nothing and pretended to ignore her. So again, the male culpability in this story, that the Irish system and state allowed men like my father to walk away without any stain on their own reputations or ramifications in their personal lives, is pretty appalling.
The writer and journalist Katrina Palmer with Mary Wilson on Monday. Did you know that when Bill Clinton was President of the United States, apart from the weighty policy tomes and top secret documents he had to read, he was also a voracious thriller reader? Well, now he's written his own, in collaboration with best-selling novelist James Patterson. It's called The President is Missing. Both Bill Clinton and James Patterson were Ryan Tuberty's guests on Tuesday.
Well, I've wanted to write a thriller for years, but I just, you know, never got around to it. And the person who deserves credit for getting us together is Bob Barnett, who's our, by coincidence, our lawyer, agent, friend, And he came to me and he said, you know, I've been trying to get you to do this for years. You've never done it. Why don't you do one with James Patterson? I said, oh, he'd never do that. So I talked to Jim and he said yes, and we were off to the races. I just always wanted to do it.
But everything in here could happen, literally everything. And if it happened, this is the way it would happen, whether it's an attack on the president's motorcade or the attack against the United States and really against the world that happens. That's the heart of the story.
For the two of you, the central theme of cyber attacks, there's talk of impeachment, there's talk of Russia. And I couldn't get out of my head the idea that just now more than ever in American politics, whatever about international politics, that truth is stranger than fiction. I mean, that old adage. But it just feels, even reading your book, that, God, it's hard to keep up with truth sometimes, even as fiction writers.
Well, it is. First, there's a lot happening at once. Second, we have access to more information than we ever had before. Third, we're increasingly less likely to know whether the information we have is accurate or not. Mm-hmm. And the people who don't like democracy and who want authoritarian leaders to run the world have always sought to abolish the distinction between fact and fiction and truth and lies. That's the big part of the strategy, because if citizens don't know the difference, then how can they take their own election seriously? I mean, that's the logical conclusion of this. But in the meanwhile, a whole lot of people in their ordinary, regular lives could get hurt if we mess this up.
We've had a dozen or so writers chime in who have read the book.
Yes.
And they range from Lee Child to Michael Connelly to, help me out here.
Women, Louise Penny.
Louise Penny.
Okay. Mary Higgins Clark.
And we've heard the same thing from almost all of them, which is that this has the beauty and the interest and the facts of a memoir, but it's incredibly fast-paced.
Mm.
It's a thriller.
Mm.
It's like a memoir on speed. And,
yes.
And I think that's a great combination for readers.
It's a challenge both to entertain and to get people interested in doing something serious about something that needs to be addressed.
Yes.
And we'll see if we did it, but we tried.
Bill Clinton and James Patterson, heard on The Ryan Tuberty Show. Well, the celebrated Booker Prize-winning novelist and environmental activist Margaret Atwood was also a guest on Ryan's show. She's written so many amazing books, but inevitably the conversation turned to her dystopian novel The Handmaid's Tale, which, as you know, has been turned into a hugely successful, if very disturbing, television series.
Halfway during the first season of The Handmaid's Tale, as it was made into a TV program, the American people chose to elect Donald Trump as their president.
Wasn't that something? Yeah, so we were shooting the show, and we had started in September, and the cast and crew woke up on November the 9th and said to themselves and to each other, we're in a different show. Nothing changed in the script. The frame changed.
It did.
So it's going to be viewed differently, and that's exactly what happened. So instead of saying, phew, we elected Hillary Clinton, so we won't have The Handmaid's Tale. Everybody said, here comes The Handmaid's Tale.
They did. And shortly after the president was elected, you saw the signs up in rallies going, The Handmaid's Tale is not a policy document.
Then you started getting the sit-ins in legislatures of women dressed like handmaids, which is quite brilliant because they're not saying anything or causing a disruption. They're just visible. They're just there. So we've had that not just in the States, but around the world. And I think during the lead up to the referendum, there were some handmaids here.
That's right. That's outside our national parliament building.
Yeah.
It's certainly struck a chord. And
well, unhappily, because I wrote the book back in the middle 80s.
Yes.
And you would think, if you're a believer in ever unfolding, inevitable, better and better for everyone type of thing, you would think, well, this will never happen.
Well, you would have written Pollyanna then. If it
I would have, yeah. it's not my usual type.
Not your thing.
No.
Regressive fiction. Speculate about the future. Do you think the world is going to get better and brighter? We're going to learn? Or are we in a vicious cycle of deafness to history?
All right. So there is no the future. There is no set in stone the future that will inevitably arrive, because there are too many variables and too many things you can't predict, such as the election of Donald Trump. So we can't talk about the future, but we can talk about the fact that we have a number of choices. And if we make this set of choices, we will get a better and brighter future. And if we make that set of choices, we will not. And one of the biggest determinants is how are we going to handle the planet? What are we going to do about what we've done to the planet? Because short story, oceans die, we're gone. They make the majority of the oxygen atoms that you and I are breathing.
Margaret Atwood with Ryan Tubridy yesterday. Well, there are just a few days to go before the Trump-Kim high-stakes summit is expected to take place. It's hoped the talks will pave the way towards rebuilding the relationship between North and South Korea. But Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland, who's just returned from a trip to Seoul, had other things on his mind when he spoke about his experiences to Derek Mooney on Mooney Goes Wild.
What I did see in Seoul was quite very telling. I've never seen a place with more advertisements for plastic surgery. Plastic surgery clinics everywhere. And you actually see people on the subway and on the buses quite commonly with their noses in bandages or with obviously just had work done or even with stitches and facelifts and so on. And it's very common. Just you see it a lot on the streets and nobody bats an eyelid. Maybe the cat bat their eyelids. The wildlife there was really, really good because Korea, if you look at it on the map, obviously the peninsula sticks out right into the ocean. So it's the shortest crossing point for lots of birds returning from Southeast Asia and from Australia. And actually, the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea is well known as a very good area for lots of birds because the demilitarized zone is full of landmines. And that means that a lot of ground predators, you know, can't live there. So anything like a fox goes in, it blows up. So a lot of these birds there are you know, they actually can nest in peace and there's no humans disturbing them.
And they're too light to send off the land bombs.
Exactly. So there's cranes in there nesting and there's all sorts of birds in the trees. It's very, very good. It's also very interesting to see the magpies in the city. So they have magpies just like ours in Seoul. But what people comment on is they look far cuter than ours do.
God,
they have shorter
beaks. They've obviously had some facial surgery done or something like that.
Too. But go on, yeah. They have shorter beaks and they just have more kindly looking faces. I don't know. And the other thing too, our magpies here, if you look at them closely, I think magpies are really beautiful birds. But we have ours here have all sorts of iridescences in their plumage. So there's blues and there's bronzes and greens. Yeah. The ones in Korea, just blue. No trace of green, no turquoise or bronze in them, just very, very blue.
So blue iridescence.
Blue iridescence, yeah, in the black feathers, yes, which was quite interesting.
Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland on his recent trip to Seoul, which has been described as the cosmetic surgery capital of the world, but is also a relatively unknown nature and wildlife paradise. 7 years ago, at the age of 23, Austrian law student Max Schrems asked Facebook for all the information the company had stored about him, and that action changed the lives of millions of people. Since then, Schrems has become a kind of folk hero for privacy activists, and he now runs the organisation None of Your Business. Max Schrems was in Dublin to give the keynote address at Ireland's Edge, a coded culture in Trinity College. He spoke with Richard Curran.
You asked Facebook initially for the data that they held on you.
So originally I made an access request. Everybody has the right to go to any company and say, I want to have a copy of all the data you hold on me. In the case of Facebook, that ping-ponged a bit. After a while, I got 1,200 pages from Facebook in 2011. And you got to say, I kind of posted something once a week, so I was not a heavy Facebook user. And a lot of the data was actually data I haven't put on Facebook. So oftentimes people feel like if they don't share something online, then they're safe. But the reality is that Facebook has even what they call shadow profiles, so profiles on people that don't even have a Facebook profile because other people share information and you can then build data out of that. And the interesting thing was not necessarily that they have a lot of data, but that they were stupid enough to send me a lot of the data that they shouldn't have had legally. So for example, I could see about 300 pages of deleted messages that I previously deleted. And a lot of that was very sensitive. For example, a friend of mine had psychological issues and was in a closed unit at a hospital, and she would message me on Facebook. And I deleted these messages because they're very personal, but they weren't deleted. They were stored in the background by Facebook. They were so-called flagged as deleted. So they mark it as deleted, but it stays on the server, just that you as a user can't see them anymore.
And this prompted your complaint and the case that you took, and you were successful in relation to that. You also have other complaints and cases in train. Is it now a personal mission, a personal crusade for you?
Interestingly, it's never a crusade. I more see it as a chess player, something like that. Because now we're moving into this digital age, we'll have to debate who has power over your information, which person has how much rights on your, you know, device, on your profiles and so on. And 90% of digitalization is great. And that's always important to highlight. But there are downsides to things as well. There's debates like, I don't know, fake news. There's stuff on how this changes our democracy or our society. And there's this privacy debate, which is only one of the many debates in digitalization. And I think the privacy debate is interesting because if we move into an information age, information is going to be more powerful than it has ever been. And then the fundamental question is, who has power over that information? Is it going to be 4 or 5 companies globally that then decide basically everything in that area? Or do we see the individualist mainly having that power. And I'm a big fan of the second. And I think we'll have to make sure that that also reaches reality. And GDPR, the new law that we have on the European Union now, the General Data Protection Regulation, allows a lot of that actually. And this is possibly a way to get there.
Privacy activist and lawyer Max Schrems, heard on the Today Show on Wednesday. It was typical exam weather this week as thousands of students began their Leaving and Junior certs, and all that sunshine made comedian Colm O'Regan nostalgic for the good old days at the seaside.
I was looking through holiday photos from my childhood. One thing that struck me is how much our pose has changed in holiday snaps. Cameras are different, and also we were different people. I think we were less willing 20 or 30 years ago to be the centre of attention. So a holiday photo now is often a selfie, and your face takes up 80% of the photo. You could have the Taj Mahal in the background, yet there's incredible detail of your nasal hair in the front. But photos long ago were different. Your father would stand as far back as possible to get the whole of the castle in, and his family were only an incidental detail in it. And in the family would consist of your mother shielding her face from the camera while also disciplining a child. But what I also noticed is if you look at enough photos down through the years, you see the same jumper move its way down through the children. If you flicked through the photos, it would actually appear like an animation. It's incredible. One of the great wonders of nature is the sunbathing Irish person. And Ireland is becoming less homogenous, so we sometimes forget still how damn white we still are. And you really see the whiteness in an early summer's day where we're kind of released, blinking into the sun. Sometimes we can take the sun worship a little too far. Thankfully, there's an answer.
Are you sore, uncomfortable, prone to getting into fights in the park by 4 p.m?
Ole, what are you looking at?
You could be suffering from sun cans.
Sun cans?
Sun cans is a common condition caused primarily by drinking cans in the sun. There are a number of symptoms. People telling you you've got a bit of colour.
Oh, did I? Oh, I did. I got a colour, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. You know what that is now? Pound shop sunscreen. It's practically butter.
Taking your watch off to see the contrast.
Ah, would you look at that? Look at the difference where the watch was. Ah, now that's only after an hour. By the end of the day, I'll be like Omar Sharif.
Thinking it'll turn to tan even though it never does.
It's not sunburn. It's pre-tan. Sure, I've a bit of Spanish blood in me going way back. The Armada. They rode all around them, you know.
An extract there from Colm O'Regan Wants a Word, starring the man himself, with Tara Flynn and Paul Tylak, heard on Bank Holiday Monday. Well, there was a fantastic outbreak of name-dropping on the Marion Finucane show last Saturday, and why not? Marion and her guests, the piper Paddy Maloney and artist Anthony Palliser, were remembering their late great friend, the Guinness heir Gareth Brown, who held epic parties at his ancestral home in Lugalaw in County Wicklow with people like Mick Jagger, Marianne Faithfull, Charlotte Rampling and filmmaker John Boorman just swinging by. Anyway, Anthony Palliser's exhibition of Irish portraits face to face is now on view to the public at Farmley House and naturally includes a portrait of Gareth himself.
Now, you were best man at Gareth Brown's wedding.
I was indeed.
Tell us about that. It sounded magical.
It was. It was completely. See, my main job as best man was making sure he didn't run for it, you know. And he did. He managed.
Yeah.
I mean, I turned round for a second. He was gone. And the clock was ticking. And, you know, this was going to be a seven-hour ceremony. And I had a silly turban on my head. I say silly because white men with turbans do look a bit silly.
Yeah, and, as indeed do white women in saris.
Indeed. Unless they're sort of very dark. I mean, well, obviously. Well, I panicked and I was cursing a lot and sort of wondering where he might be. Called the Taj, you know, the sort of the usual bars. And it's just because he was so nervous.
Describe who she is, because she's still alive.
She is.
And how they met up and why that worked for them.
I don't know all the sort of very early mechanics of the thing. They both were deeply fond of each other. That's absolutely sure, and to the end. But they had a sort of, the least one I can say, is unconventional marriage. They spent a lot of the year separate. She would be in India or in Singapore, and he would be in Europe. But every year he spent some time with her. And she always did him good. He always looked much better. And really, I'm very fond of her.
She was Indian royalty, I suppose.
Absolutely. And so if you get Irish aristocracy marrying Indian royalty, you get fireworks. I mean, it was, it really was mad. Eddie Delaney arrived, the sculptor, with two tweed suits. That was his luggage.
Right.
And the day after the wedding, he reprimanded Gareth. He said, it was fun, but there were no elephants. He was expecting elephants. You know?
Portrait artist Anthony Palliser with Marion Finucane last Saturday. Few people can claim instant recognisability for their creative work, but designer Orla Kiley certainly can. She's been in business for 21 years and she's also celebrating 20 years of her handbags being sold by the Kilkenny shop in Ireland. Her career is being marked by a special exhibition at the Fashion and Textile Museum in London. In fact, London has been crucial to Orla's success. She did a master's at the Royal College of Art, and it's there, in London, that Richard Curran picks up the story.
You obviously progressed very quickly because, am I right in saying, your London thesis on hats, the range that you developed as part of that, was bought by Harrods?
Yes. I mean, when I left the Royal College, I'd done a small capsule rate collection of hats, and Harrods did buy them. And alongside that, I decided to do some bags to go with. And they were very simple. And my father came over to visit while we were selling at London Fashion Week. And his famous words were that, I mean, they were very important back then, he noticed every woman was carrying a handbag, but they were not wearing hats. So
he was applying a sort of a business perspective
an
observation.
And basically saying, focus on handbags. There's a future there. So it was very wise.
A bit of people watching, which paid off in a big way. Orla Kiley heard on The Business with Richard Curran. Well, I hope you'll stay tuned for Richard. He'll be here shortly after the 10 o'clock news. But I'll leave you now with a stunning rendition of Galway Girl from Mundy and the Sharon Shannon Band. They were live in session with Fiachna O'Brien on Bank Holiday Monday. And do yourself a favour. It's well worth listening back to the entire programme. Goramaga Vaswar Goluther, Gideon Tachtan Chahagin, Kajeshim Slan.
I took a stroll down the old long walk in the day. I met a little girl and we stopped to talk on a fine soft day. And I ask you, friends, what's a fella to do? Because her hair was black and her eyes were blue. And I knew right then I'd be taking a whirl down the Salt Hill prom with a Galway girl. The day she asked me up to her flat downtown on a fine soft day. And I ask you, friends, what's a fella to do? Well, if her hair was black and her eyes were blue, so I took her hand and I gave her a twirl, and I lost my heart to a Galway girl. I woke up, I was all alone on the day, with a broken heart and a ticket home. And I ask you, friends, what would you do? Well, if her hair was black and her eyes were blue. You see, I traveled around, I've been all over the world. And boys, well, I've never seen nothing like a Galway girl.